Here we are, starting a new third recording, and we're reviewing the lecture notes. So anyone listening to this, you'll have to try and pick up from the lecture notes what I'm talking about, because there'll be stuff on screen that you can't see. I might bother to mention the page number if I do remember, so you can follow it. So with this documentary, I guess.
Could you straighten it?
It's usually like that because of the angle that it's at.
Is it the book then?
Yeah, it's just
the book me.
It's am I making that worse?
No.
Better. Better. Better.
Yeah,
it's good. Oh. I don't know if I make that go the other way.
Just put the book on the left hand side.
Just maybe change the wall.
And a thinner book. thinner book.
Could take some more pages out there. I mean, fold it.
That's better, isn't it? Don't you think? That will do. It's not perfection, but it will. So, just talking to what I was talking about earlier, the thing about the documentary, which if you haven't watched it, I advise you just kind of refresh your mind with it, is that he's asking what is reality. I think that's the title of that first episode. The assumption is in him is that that's a question that science should answer, which means it's not. Science already has an answer about what is reality, which he's going to express in this program. So the underlying assumption there is that the philosophical question, what is reality, in some sense has already been answered and doesn't need to be addressed. But at another level, when we say that there's certain philosophical assumptions in our culture, it's not even recognised as a question that we might investigate before science gets hold of it, if you like. It's not even recognised that there's a background of assumptions within which science is operating. And this is, I guess, the sense that things are disguised for us, because people who are scientists come in the way that you're saying, without any real philosophical background. That's not to say that people are unaware of philosophy, but generally there's an attitude, especially amongst empirical scientists, that philosophy is a sort of a waste of time. I don't know if you remember Stephen Hawking's had stuff to say on this. Generally, scientists, especially who are at the top of their field, regard people who are interested in philosophy as kind of people who are ignorant of science. That being a philosopher expresses a certain ignorance of science, because science, of course, can answer all these questions. What is reality? And there's a sort of an attitude, quite steeped, quite deep, that philosophers just kind of sit in armchairs, reading books and introspecting. And have got nowhere. You know, they've been doing that since Plato. And what's philosophy done for us? You know, it's like what the Rome has done for us, if you know Monty Python. What's philosophy done for us? Nothing. What's science done for us? Well, just look around. You know, there's a kind of a background argument that says science is so effective. Science is what's produced all of this technology, transformed our lives utterly, The proof is in the pudding, I think we used to say, didn't we? The proof is in what it's achieved and how it's continuously progressing. It can't be wrong. If we're going to listen to philosophy, well, you know, it's like the world we live in. What are the outcomes of all of that philosophy? Basically, the outcome is just a whole series of different philosophers who disagree with each other. So the whole of philosophy, it can be easily sidelined with that kind of attitude. But that still doesn't ignore the fact that the question of what is reality is a philosophical question, and modern science, in relation to this kind of documentary, has come up with a certain answer to that remains unquestioned. And remains unquestioned partly because of the, partly because our culture has such a low opinion of philosophy. I'd be inclined to say that philosophy itself has a part to play in that. I'm not saying that the philosophers, professional philosophers, have been blameless in that, because philosophy has become such a specialism in its own right, and so caught up in arguments within itself, that it hasn't really exerted any coherent influence on the culture around it. An influence that, if you like, the birth of philosophy in with the Greeks, philosophy was alive and kicking and living. And in a way, I think the last time philosophy was like that here was probably after the Second World War, with the philosophy of language that came out. There was not that it necessarily produced a positive influence, but it was paid attention to. Who really pays attention to what the philosophers are saying now? It is a question of paying attention to what the scientists are saying now, and particularly brain scientists. They're having increasing influence in our understanding of what it is to be human. Again, you could say that's a philosophical question. So what is Eagleman's view is that, quoting him at random, and I have to acknowledge that it's difficult when you're just given a documentary like that. You do make a straw man out of somebody. You know, a straw man is not—it's not the real man. It's a man of straw that you've put up because you can just knock him down. And you say, "Look, he just fell over just like that." If Eagleman was here, I think you'd find his views were more nuanced than I'm portraying them. Because I did look into him a little bit, and he was interested enough in Eastern philosophy to have an interview with some obscure Eastern mystic. So he's interested. A lot of people in this area are interested in broader aspects of consciousness, but again, within a brain scanning kind of mentality, they're interested in alternative states of consciousness, because they might be telling us something about how the brain works, rather than being interested in alternative states of consciousness in their own right, so to speak. So he says, though he does say this, so we can quote him here: "No one's having an experience of objective reality." Now, if as philosophers, we would have to sit him down and say, "Do you really mean that, David? Is this table objectively real? Aren't you having an experience of it?" Well, we'll come to that. I'd like you to see that he boldly makes that statement in the midst of this long program, and it didn't stick in your throat. It ought to stick in your throat. No one's having an experience of objective reality. It's a pretty, what could he mean by that? of the world that really truly exists. And he does say this in his delightful, really truly. It's like, I'm going to tell you the honest truth, as opposed to the dishonest truth, you know. You know, if the more you emphasize it, the more real it becomes. Now, if it's real, it's real. That's part of the word. If it's true, it's true. You don't need to have really true. Anyway, that's just my kind of concern about the use of language. And he wants to say, yeah, what really truly exists, for example, when we look out of our eyes, we're only sensitive to a terribly narrow bandwidth of electromagnetic radiation. What really truly exists is that full spectrum of electromagnetic radiation. But do you see that just being careful with language, because you don't see it all, doesn't mean that there's an implication here in a way that to see it all would be to see objectively, would be to see objective reality. So you see quietly he's making very poor philosophical arguments here. Like, in order for us to for someone to have an experience of objective reality, then in some sense he's saying you'd have to see the whole electromagnetic spectrum. Why would he say that? I'm just jumping ahead a little bit. The reason he'd say that is because as a scientist he does have access to the entire bandwidth of electromagnetic radiation. So he's sort of saying, and he never makes it explicit, that there is a certain standpoint here where I, as a scientist, do see what really truly exists via my instruments. Yes? He never actually spells this out. That's what I mean. I think if we had David Eagleman here, he'd say, oh, well, you know, it was a documentary, John. I couldn't say everything, you know. And somebody else helped me with the script, you know. But even so, there's some very definite things being said here. So I'm just checking that everybody's, because I guess there was a certain point in my own thinking about this. I didn't get it from school. I had to work it out for myself. That this really is the case. That at the end of the day, if you start to study the brain and look into the brain, there's nothing like colour. There's nothing like sound. There's nothing like smell. As we experience it, going on in the brain. Wherever you look in the brain, it's not like the visual pathway has something extraordinarily significant about it that says, oh yeah, this must be vision, because it's so different to the part of the brain that deals with sound. It's not like that. There's no the part of the brain that deals with sound and the part of the brain that deals with vision anatomically look very, very similar. I think he uses the very word. The currency of what goes on in the brain are electrochemical signals. By electrochemical, that just means that the electricity is generated by electrical potentials that are to do with the various strengths of solutions of chemicals that are in the fluid that the neurons are existing in. So it's not as if there's a battery sending power down the neurons. It's more to do with the charges of ions in the environment of the neurons, and as the relative strengths of different, you know, potassium and sodium ions changes, an electrical potential is produced between them that causes a current to flow. So I don't know if we're going to look into that in more detail or if we need to. I might do in one of the lectures look into more detail exactly how a neuron functions. But you shouldn't think of it like a electric circuit. It works much more slowly than that. So that the it's all about electrical potential flowing, and that doesn't flow anywhere near the speed of light. Whereas electricity flowing down a copper wire can be, you know, I think about half the speed of light is how fast electricity can flow. In the brain, I think it gets up to it might get up to 1,000 meters per second at best, which is pretty fast in a little place like that. But given given what has to happen there, it's compared, say, to a computer, it's terribly slow. They're very different. But those electromagnetic signals in the brain, what's happening with the neurons, put simplistically, is that they've got this, I mean, it's an extraordinary dendritic arbor, as it's called. There are all these dendrites coming out of it. So I think a typical cell just has a body, a membrane around it, and a nucleus. And what distinguishes neurons is that growing out of that, it's like the membrane has extended itself into these tendrils that are dendrites, and these tendrils branch like trees, and they connect to the other part of the neuron, which is the axon. So there are dendrites typically maybe a single axon coming out of the neuron that also branches off into these tendrils. And the tendrils of the axons of neurons connect to the tendrils of the dendrites of other neurons. And very simplistically, these electrochemical potentials build up in the neuron, and this is still, you know, people are learning all the time that the way that neurons function, this is a terribly simplistic picture I'm giving to you, but it's partially true. It's partly it does happen, and there are other things going on. What happens is the neuron receives energy through its dendrites, electrical potential through its dendrites, which connects it to other neurons. And as that potential builds up, it reaches a critical point where the neuron itself fires, as we say. The potential builds up to a certain level where it discharges, and it discharges through the axon, and the axon branches, and the axon is connected to other neurons, and that discharge gives energy to the other neurons. One single neuron can be connected to thousands of others, and there are billions of neurons in the brain. So and the gist of Eagleman's understanding is that what we're experiencing now is determined by the interconnections of the neurons in our brains, and the dissemination of what he's calling those electrochemical signals that actually become neurons firing, communicating with other neurons. And do you see the way that the neurons are connected and which other neurons they're connected to is going to determine whether they fire or not? That simplistic picture, although I'm saying there is greater complexity in why a particular neuron will fire. But basically, for a neuron to fire, it has to be connected to a sufficient number of other neurons that are also firing. And what happens, if you like, I'm sorry to give you I'm not sorry, but I feel I should just give you a rough picture. The neurons finally in the brain are connected up to sensory receptors, which get energy from the environment, and that energy goes up through the nervous system to the brain, and the brain also is connected up to all of the muscles in the body, the neurons in the brain can discharge in such a way as to control the muscles that control your body, your speech, your larynx, your eyes, everything about what you do is this continuous matter of this, computer science would say, information coming in to the sensory receptors and information going out to the muscles that change one of the thing, key things to understand about what the muscles are doing is the muscles are changing what the sensory receptors are going to receive. You walk across the room to, in order to change, you flick your eyes in order to change what's good. So the system is in a continuous state of what we would call feedback. It's not as if there's sensory stuff coming here, motor stuff going out there. The motor stuff changes the sensory stuff. So it's this continuous recycling of this electrochemical signals in the brain, receiving information, discharging through the muscles, changing information, so that we're continuously cycling around. That's science, right? We didn't know that not so long ago. Some cultures thought it was the heart that was responsible for doing this. But it's become very clear that it's the brain, and it's become particularly clear through studies of brain damage. And anyone who's encountered anyone who's had a brain disease will see this very, very clearly. We're utterly dependent on the state of this physical organ, and if it starts to malfunction, then your reality, as Eagleman would say, goes with it. Yeah, there's no, you can't just say it ain't true. My consciousness is somewhere over there, and it's nothing to do with the brain. You can't say it would have been possible to say that if you were a Greek, but even then, you know, people must have been brain damaged in those days, and you would have seen the dramatic effects of that. So, and I go further. I may have said this in the earlier course. I go further to say that what I'm experiencing now, perceptually, is I think one thing about consciousness that we should sort of recognize, and people are studying, and this is scientific again, is that consciousness is actually associated with certain processes happening in the brain right now, and not with your foot, for instance. Now, there's an important dividing line here, which I think, given we're doing philosophy of consciousness, even if I mentioned it in the course before, we should recognise. You would say, sure, I'm conscious of what's going on in my foot, right? Well, I want to draw a line of, well, if we're trying to find where is consciousness actually situated, if you're looking into the world, which is what brain scientists are interested in, is there a consciousness in my toe? And the answer to that is no. It's not that there's consciousness in your toe, it's that your toe has receptors that have communicated up to a certain area in your brain. Now, the sort of test here would be you could get rid of the foot and the receptors in the foot, and you could send the signal to the brain in some other way that was nothing to do with the foot. And if you were able to send exactly the right signals, then you would experience having a toe. You'd experience having a leg, yes? And in a way, you've got a kind of a thought experiment here to say, well, how much could you take away until you reached a point where your consciousness would no longer be aware of you having a body or aware of having the world? Do you see? How far could you shrink it until you'd actually be taking away your experience by replacing actual things with substitute things that are just reproducing that the same information? And this is the brain in the vat thought experiment, so beloved of philosophers, do you know that? So beloved of the Matrix, if you remember. The Matrix was in popular culture the expression of that, you can't carry on and on and on. In the end, there will be certain key processes that are actually responsible for your experiencing this room, and they haven't been identified as yet in precisely, but people are working on it, and people are working on it at Sussex University, for instance, and it looks like it's not as if you could say, oh, this bit of my brain is conscious and this bit isn't. It's more that there's a certain process going on at this moment, and it's that process that's conscious, and it's using a bit of your brain. Yeah, and because your consciousness changes, the process will be using another part of your brain, and the part of your brain that was conscious a few moments ago, it's no longer involved in your consciousness, but there'll be a certain process now that's involved in your being conscious, and then you'll go to sleep and the process itself will die away, but you might start dreaming and there'll be some minimal consciousness of another process that's going on, and there'll be many, many processes going on in the brain at the same time that aren't conscious. And that's what brain science is interested in at the moment, is, well, which exact ones are conscious and what's their distinguishing feature? And there are many hypotheses put forward. Actually, Jung, which is from years ago, his hypothesis was that the parts that you're conscious of are to do with the exercising of your volition. So you're conscious of what you're capable of changing, which is not a bad definition, because in actual fact you can become conscious of processes going on in your body that ordinarily you're not with training. If you can get some kind of control over things that are going on inside your body, you start becoming conscious of them. I'm not saying that's the key, but there will be some kind of distinguishing feature, I think, about the processes that are conscious, not just phenomenologically, but in the brain itself. You'll say, ah, yes, processes like that will be conscious, and processes like that are unconscious. And there are various parts of the midbrain and the brain stem that also have to be active in order for there to be consciousness there. But are they conscious? Again, we're not going to go into the question of exactly, that's a brain science question, but the interesting thing, I think, to recognise, because we're thinking of science now, not phenomenology, is there's another way of understanding this, because Eagleman was talking about time as well. If something happens in your toe, it will take time for you to be conscious of it. That's another way of saying that your consciousness isn't actually in your toe. There'll be a delay. And if you like, in world time, because we're talking science now, that delay will be the amount of time it takes the signal to propagate up your leg, through your spine, into your brain, to the area in your brain that is actually conscious of what's going on in your foot. Another way of defining what the process that is conscious is that there'll be no time delay. Whatever is happening in that process, you are experiencing instantaneously. It's not as if that process then communicates through some other nerve fibre to some other neuron, and then you're conscious, right? There's going to be a certain area, and this is extraordinary, isn't it? So there are certain processes in the brain where there's no communication. This is where consciousness becomes weird, right? So everything else in the world, you say there's time delay, yeah? Things can't travel faster than the speed of light, except in quantum mechanics there are some strange effects where it does seem like there is instantaneous communication. But in classical physics, it takes time for everything to propagate. But there's going to be a place in the brain where there is no time between what happens there and your being conscious. Or at least let me say, I am proposing that that is how it...
There's no evidence of that, is there?
How could you... The question then would be, how could you measure that?
Yeah, there's nothing to measure, is there?
I'm saying... how can you... You can't measure what somebody's conscious of to... I'm talking to that degree of granularity. It is possible to recognise that there's a delay between something happening in your foot and you becoming conscious of it, but as you get closer and closer to, if you like, the seat of consciousness in the brain, the time, all we could say is there's a graph here, right? It's getting closer and closer to zero. And somewhere towards the beginning of that process, it's going to be zero. And if it isn't zero, yes, there may be a surprise there. There are various issues to do with time that I'll just mention now, because we did talk about time and Husserl's experience of consciousness of time. Because I remember having a discussion with somebody at Sussex about this, who disagreed with me, who thought maybe consciousness as a field actually retains what was happening a few seconds ago in the brain. So there's an interesting question there, whether consciousness is poised in this very moment. Susie. This is Susie. Susie's from the class of 17. Yeah, that's right. If we can squeeze Susie in.
Sorry.
Yes, I'm digressing a little bit, but this is an interesting question, and it's... Yes, Boris.
Maybe it's not related, but I want to tell you. And there is something called radiculopathy, that is a nerve trap in the spine. And what happened? Because you had that problem, then you, for example, you feel that you have broken arm. You feel the pain of broken arm. But also, if you are conscious that you have not the arm broken,
yes,
you feel the pain. That means that the brain ordered to feel pain in the arm. But
yes.
You are conscious, no, I don't have the arm broken, it's fine.
Yes.
But still you have the pain.
Yes, and that's like a demonstration that you're not conscious of your arm. I mean, and there are... I don't think he did the rubber hand experiment in that program, did he? But are you aware of the rubber hand experiment? Oh, that's another very clear demonstration that you're not conscious of your hand. What happens is somebody you put your hand here, and there's a rubber hand placed right next to it, and your hand is covered, so that you're not able to see it. And then the rubber hand, somebody starts just lightly stroking it, while at the same time, you can't see it, your actual hand is being stroked at the same time. And after a while, your perceptual sense that your hand is being stroked behind this... You know, you first of all, you feel the location of your hand being stroked. You can't see your hand, but you know that something's happening to your hand under there. After a while, and this is quite reliable, though I haven't had it done to myself, you switch and you start experiencing that this rubber hand, even though you can see it's a rubber hand, is your hand, and your sense of the location of your hand moves to there.
It's a bit like the sight thing that was talked about, wasn't it, in that program, an explanation.
Yes, when the prisms, the prisms are inverting your sight.
Yeah.
But I mean, that fascinated people in for years, that the image on the retina is upside down. So how come you don't see things upside down? Because we have such a strong sense that what I'm experiencing is somehow I'm there's a, you remember, this is the homunculus illusion, that there's a little person in your head looking at the back of your retina, and how come that person doesn't see that it's upside down? Do you see the mistake there is thinking that there's some other consciousness inside the brain looking at the back of the eye. What you're conscious of is a if you like, what consciousness consists in is a certain process occurring in visual cortex, probably, that isn't one way up or another. In fact, it's according to that process and all the other processes that are going on in the other parts of the brain, that the brain works out what way is up. And that, and in the program, that's what happens over a week or so. You actually relearn which way is up. And how do you relearn it? Well, and I don't dispute this. The neurons in the brain grow new connections. And as those connections grow, your experience changes. Do you see? So we have to get steeped in this, this view, because we don't. The point here is not to end up being kind of people who reject science without appreciating the extraordinary knowledge that it's giving us. Do you know, the only problem, if I can reiterate, with science is that behind science there's a certain philosophical understanding that's unexamined, that leads you to understand the what's being discovered in a certain light. Which has there are deep reasons for this. If we all went around with an entirely different background understanding about how things work, we'd find it very hard to live together or run an economy or even serve someone in a shop. You know, there's very good reasons which we could say, again, if we listen to science, we'd say very good evolutionary reasons why we come to a collective understanding about how things are, and we stick to it rather tenaciously. Because the evolutionary idea would say, well, yeah, there were these other people who didn't do that. You know, they were just changing their view of the world every day. And I'm afraid we killed them. They died out.
What happens if you've got a different understanding, collective understanding of the world? Which some people do have.
Well, what happens is,
it's not wrong, is it? It's different.
No, it's not wrong, but generally what happens is the person who has a different understanding has to come to some accommodation with all the others, or they get sectioned, don't they? Do you know that's the basic story. And different cultures have different toleration of that. I mean, our culture, I think, has moved into probably the greatest tolerance that's ever been seen on the planet for people having alternative versions of reality. Typically, you were just...
You mean our culture as in this country or the world?
No, as in the kind of... I just wanted to... Because I've been given a lot of criticism of Western scientific culture and its kind of globalized view of things, but in effect it also has come to us a kind of an objectivity about many things, including an objectivity which has resulted in a certain tolerance of difference, that previous worldviews, it was you're either with us or you're against us. And if you're against us, it's generally, or we'll torture you out of your alternative view. Yeah, you know, it's in that particular area but at the same time, it only goes so far, right? And generally, it's to do with whether you become violent in some way, or you start stealing things. You know, it's to do with whether you respect the law, I think, isn't it?
Or if you take drugs. So is this respecting the law?
Yeah.
Anything?
Yeah.
Because there's some cultures that use drugs to get them into a different consciousness.
Yes. And that's our culture does that, and our culture tolerates it on the fringes, doesn't it? And is beginning to tolerate it in the mainstream now. That's going to be interesting, isn't it? The consequences of that. Because we are, you know, we're tolerating all kinds of dimensions of sexuality, you know, and it's all happening in my own lifetime, this kind of broadening out. Quite extraordinary changes happening in that direction. But we're digressing, and here I go. So let's go back. We're still on. We're in slide 5, and we're saying that Eagleman has an idea of what's real, true reality. And we made a large digression into the what's going on in the brain, and that in terms of our scientific understanding of things. If we are going to look for consciousness in what Eagleman calls the real, true, objective world, that's where we end up. We end up in the brain. We end up with those electrochemical signals that are all firing at this extraordinary complexity in the brain. And typically, if we say that we're studying consciousness in our modern culture, what we mean is we're studying the electrochemical signals that are going on inside the brain. Yeah, we're doing neuroscience, but not pure neuroscience. It's not that we're uninterested in people's experience, because the only way that we're able to identify the areas of the brain that are conscious is by inquiring of people, well, what are you experiencing now? What are you experiencing now? And you're either looking at someone with brain damage, or you're looking into a scanner and you're saying, well, what are you experiencing now? And I'm looking at what's happening in your brain. But you can't just look at the brain. You need the and this is where phenomenology is now used in the mainstream world. You need to know about the phenomenology of the person's experience. But you need to be on guard, having done this course, that when people talk about that, they don't mean that what Husserl and Heidegger meant by phenomenology. They just mean what science calls the first-person aspect of experience, the touchy-feely coloredness of it. And if you like, the third-person aspect of experience, the objective aspect of experience, is the stuff going on in the brain. And many neuroscientists will explicitly say what's going on in the brain is consciousness. There's no two things. And yet, at the same time, I think, as philosophers, we would say, well, you're saying something very strange there. Leibniz, Leibniz was in the 1600s. I mean, he saw this 400 years ago. He basically said, well, you know, if I was to miniaturize myself, because there was no brain scans then, obviously, and I was able to get inside a brain and walk around in it, I just wouldn't see anything like colour. There wouldn't be any sound. There wouldn't be anything like consciousness going on in there. All I would discover observing from the outside would be all of this physical stuff going on. It's the fact that all of that physical interaction is required in order for me to be conscious isn't something you can just kind of say, well, that's because they are the same thing. The fact that there's this experience of consciousness is it's deeply mysterious to a scientific understanding that thinks that everything is physical. Yes, there's a, and as I banged on about in this lecture previously, Eagleman expresses this. He recognizes it with the word somehow, which I, if I can get attuned you to that, he keeps saying, and somehow all of this activity going on in the brain becomes your experience. And the somehow, it's kind of left there unaddressed. As if, and this is what a lot of people working in brain science kind of think, as if, well, given a few more years, so that we'll understand that somehow. Whereas, if you look at it in a straightforward way, the very philosophical background within from which that person is coming from is such that that somehow can never be bridged, because you've already posed an insoluble problem. How did you pose it? Well, sort of Descartes started it off. He said there's this res extensa, there's this physical extended stuff, and there's this consciousness, and the physical extended stuff and the consciousness are two entirely separate things. Descartes. And if you like, Western philosophy has been struggling with that ever since. It doesn't want to give up on the idea of the physical being the absolutely objectively real and determining ground of everything. And yet, we can get, if you accept that, then consciousness emerges as a kind of inexplicable phenomenon. Yes.
I had a brief discussion with my husband about the sort of the course and talking about the phenomenology, and he said the problem is, because I was just discussing, having read a little bit of the literature about comparing, and I try in my slightly poor language way to explain to him what we're doing. And he said, but the problem is consciousness is a concept, and so you can't ever explain consciousness in the same way as science would, as the scientific method explains things. Is that correct? Do you see, is consciousness, could you describe it as a concept? And so it's something completely different that you wouldn't ever explain with science, or is that completely off tangent?
So, if you listen to Daniel Dennett or read Daniel Dennett, he's a kind of philosopher who expresses that point of view,
right?
Where he says, and I'm not sure what your husband means by concept.
Well, that's the thing.
But Dennett, I think Dennett comes down to the position. Dennett sort of set himself the task of making a philosophical position that would allow the kind of physicalism of science to be consistent. Yes, so, and he's a very intelligent person. So he came to the conclusion that our idea of consciousness is just that. It's a kind of a concept that we have.
That's a concept, idea is another word.
Yeah, but, and in effect, it's an illusion. The idea that we have that we're conscious is an illusion, right? Because if we follow the precepts of science, it just don't show up.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a kind of a false idea that we have that we're conscious, because when you study it properly scientifically, There is no, you can't find it. It's not there.
Yeah.
So Dennett actually tries to make that case.
So he's coming at it with that ingrained view of scientific method being the only approach.
Yes, and if you stick with that,
which would explain. So my husband's a mathematician.
Yes,
so.
if you stick with that approach, that third person approach. You end up saying, well, consciousness is just something that people report having.
Right.
But if we use the methods of materialistic or physicalistic science or objective science, which says only what can be measured is really real, really truly real, then consciousness, in some sense, is not real, because we've already got our reality standard. So the best we can do to explain it is to say, well, it's just a kind of an idea that we have, a kind of way of speaking.
Mm. So, and in doing that, you preclude the possibility of actually ever finding out what consciousness is.
Well, no, and Dennett's famous book is called Consciousness Explained.
Oh, right.
And he explains it away in that fashion. As a form or a way of speaking that we have, that doesn't really refer to anything that's real.
So does he come from a philosophical background?
He's a philosopher.
He is a philosopher.
Yeah, right. Dennett's of all of the people who have attempted to defend this position, he's the cleanest, the
right.
purest. A lot of people try and kind of, in some sense. Muddy it up with
in that his arguments are the most logical.
Yes, yes.
But it doesn't mean to say that that's the only arguments. And just because he says it, and just because scientists say it, that does not mean to say that what other people are describing is not consciousness, and that is not true.
Exactly. I mean, that's what this course is affirming. But Dennett is. Dennett is in some sense following the consequences of physicalistic science to the end, and he ends up in an absolutely absurd position in relation to my immediate knowledge of being conscious. But you see, if you just stick to that position, my immediate knowledge of being conscious bears no evidential weight whatsoever.
Mm. And that's he's also one of the group that are of the view that religion similarly is a similar.
Yeah,
box.
He you could say that Richard Dawkins and him are the two apostles of that particular religion.
Yeah.
That particular anti-religion. Yeah, so Dawkins is the evolutionary biologist,
and
Dennett's his philosophical support.
Right.
So, but they're both seriously respected people, and Dennett probably more so.
Mm. So who on... Because they've made themselves quite well-known in mainstream...
Yes, and one of the things about this is of course, many scientists who don't have the time to, as you said, study philosophy, say, well, I don't need to. See Dennett.
Right.
Just see Dawkins. I don't need to do that. They did it all for me.
So is there an equivalent mainstream philosopher at the moment who has the same notoriety as they do, talking about the alternative?
Oh, well, in that world, which is the
media world,
not in the world of Western university Anglo-American science. So although there's European philosophy, which was, you know, in some almost derogatively called continental philosophy by people in that tradition, they have a different position. And in a way, we're more part of continental philosophy than Anglo-American philosophy. But the Anglo-American philosophers, if you like, are the mainstream for us in our culture. Dave Chalmers comes to mind as somebody who is exploring. He's really going on from Bertie Russell. He's exploring different positions that you can inhabit, where you start thinking that matter might not be quite what we think it is. Mm. Yes, because really the way to move out gently from that extreme physicalism is to start to say, well, maybe matter isn't quite what we think it is. Maybe all matter has some kind of dimension of consciousness or something like it. That matter has, instead of putting consciousness over there as completely separate, we start to say, no, well, there are different dimensions to what matter is. And you start moving into what's called panpsychism, a kind of an idea that all of the material of the universe has a kind of a potential for experience, and maybe even is having some kind of experience. So, and that way, your physics doesn't change very much.
No.
Yeah?
Just looking at things differently.
Yeah.
So what would be his evidence in the scientific world to go against the other argument?
So if you're dealing entirely scientifically and objectively, then there isn't any evidence. You have to allow that there's a different kind of evidence. And you have to allow that the evidence of your own immediate experience is has to be counted.
So it's a bit like the evidence, not evidence, it's a bit like the experience of healing, in a way. In the scientist world, there are certain healing processes which they don't recognise because they can't measure them in the same way as they can measure other healing experiences. And therefore, they don't believe that they can say that healing process works.
Well,
and they don't recognise it.
I mean, if somebody was able to heal on demand, if you see what I mean, if you could demonstrate there was a healer who could heal a certain ailment on demand, then some scientists would take it. If anything, it can be statistically repeatable, even if it's inexplicable, it'll show up in the scientific. Science isn't utterly blindfolded like that. And when I talk about science, I'm talking about neuroscience. Specifically, and branching out of that into biology, physics, and chemistry. I'm not talking about the humanities, and I'm not talking about psychology, because the humanities and psychology and philosophy itself are fractured. And there are many people who do, and politics, there are many people who believe many different things, and there's plenty of room at the table, so to speak. But in the world of cognitive science and neuroscience and the scientific study of consciousness, things are much more constrained. So, but at the same time, there's a deep prejudice against anything like paranormal powers that can't be reduced to some kind of physical explanation that involving some kind of physical force.
I mean, the argument
is
connected in neuroscience because in some cultures they say they can heal by healing the spirit, going to their
yes.
agents and selecting the spirit in order to heal. That is connected because what they're trying to do is a kind of neuro unconsciousness almost.
Yeah.
And so there is a connection, but I don't know whether they've done much research into that kind of side, or whether they're not bothered anyway.
No, the people are bothered, and there's a lot of research going into the placebo effect, you know,
yeah.
which is the fact that the brain is suggestible at certain levels.
Feel good factors, yeah.
Yeah, but that there is evidence that that we're suggestible in such a way that there are areas of the brain that are generally not accessible to consciousness that are capable of changing the body's functioning.
So like endorphins and stuff.
But not more than that, like in you know, hypnotherapy, it's a demonstrated thing that if you give someone a drug and they believe it's effective, it is effective, it can be effective, but not 100% effective. But it doesn't have to be 100% effective. It just has to be effective enough to show up in statistical trials. So that it's recognised that there's people are suggestible. And that in brain science world, that would be the explanation of healing. That if you believe in a healer, then the healer's going to be effective. If you don't believe in the healer, then the healer's not going to be effective. It's all a matter of your own belief. And the belief, a strong belief, has effects that go beyond the surface consciousness and actually affect the functioning of the body. And I think brain science is going to say, yeah, That's all explained,
yeah.
And then it'll say, "Yep, that's all."
Look for the chemicals that are released in those situations,
yes.
Won't they?
Yes.
The field of chemicals, and explain that is what's doing.
Yes.
It.
Well, they look at the brain scan as well.
Yes.
While you're having the treatment or whatever.
I mean, this is an important area. Do you see, brain science, by degrees, is going to start to explain. If our civilization continues, in greater and greater detail, more and more aspects of our experience, in programs like this that are going to become more and more convincing of the fact that your entire reality is somehow a simulation of what's going on in your brain. That view is only going to get strengthened the more science is done. And that whole idea that somehow this produces consciousness, the argument is going to be a bad one. It's going to be, well, look how much progress we've made in brain science compared to philosophy and psychology and all the rest of it. You know, they've been yabbering on Jung and Freud and all that lot, the dreams, you know, but we've made some real progress here. And it's only a matter of time before we're going to have the whole thing wrapped up. The point being, from our perspective, is you don't get an inch closer to explaining consciousness. The actuality of it, and the best that science as it is now can do, is what Dennett does, which is say, well, it's a kind of illusion, to which your only response, and this is what philosophers do, is to start hitting the table. Do you know, you can't argue any further. You get Dennett, you start shaking him and saying, "But you're conscious, surely, what's happening now?" You know, an extreme rationalist will just say, "Read my book." You know, I've been through all these arguments, and however much you try and shout and convince me that I am conscious, I can't really hear you. You know, because I've sorted it all out in my thought world. I mean, that's my psychological understanding of someone like Dennett. That in actual fact, a person like that is so extraordinarily refined as a thinker. That they never actually get out of that world where they've made things consistent in thought to actually see that the immediate experience of being conscious is, because the immediate experience of being conscious, this goes back to the beginning of the course, is not something that you can think about. It just is. And you start sounding like some kind of, you know, in front of someone like Dennett, you just start sounding like you don't have a good command of English anymore when you say something like that. Because he's expecting you to say, "Oh, okay, well, give me your argument." What are your reasons? What are you basing that on? And what's your evidence? Show me your evidence. And of course, your evidence is your own subjective immediate experience of being conscious, which is ruled out of court before you even start. So that's what I mean. So all you can do is hit the table or hit Dennett. You know, it's
what about all the studies of near-death experiences and stuff, which, you know, some studies have done quite a lot of extensive studies where things seem to be real, and then there are other studies that say they're not real.
Yes.
Like Dennett take those into consideration at all, or just dismiss them because they don't believe they exist?
Well, I don't know if Dennett would say this, but I've got his kind of one-liner, and he's good with them. The people who have had near-death experiences didn't die. Only people who die know what happens when you die. And a near-death experience is still an experience of living, of being alive.
Yeah, but evidence suggests that they physically, because I was quite interested in the brain dead bit, but they physically had died and come back.
But you haven't died. The definition of being dead is that you don't come back. That's the final definition.
Okay. It's not medically dead.
Yeah, but if you can be brought back, you haven't died until medical science starts doing Frankensteinian things. You know, Frankensteinian things like, I've taken a complete scan of your brain and now I'm going to recreate your brain and you're going to be brought back in that way. But at the moment, we don't have anything like that.
Okay, let me put it a different way. When the body shuts down in those studies and the brain still carries on, and they experience different things like white lights and or looking down at their bodies and stuff like that. So they're not dead.
Yeah.
They're shut down. Their bodies are shut down.
I mean, there is some evidence. I was reading a book that Nicolette had that people are having experiences and there's nothing going on in the brain that are interesting. Because you would expect that, but when you say there's nothing going on in the brain, it all depends what that means. It already implies that you know what bits of the brain are required for you to have an experience, and it can't be the case that nothing's going on in the brain. There'll be something going on in the brain.
But
if you like, once we've got, if you like, if we get a final neuroscience that says, well, these processes absolutely are required for you to have any experience whatsoever, and there are none of them, and you say, but I was having this amazing experience, near-death experience, and there's nothing going on in your brain, the neuroscientists will come back and say, I'm sorry, there wasn't anything going on in your brain. What you're experiencing is something that you fabricated as a memory,
yeah.
Once you came back.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you know you haven't done that, you see?
You don't. But then how do you know that they're not wrong?
You don't.
You don't.
But if you take physicalistic science as the only absolutely true and real, then you're going to say, I've explained it.
Mm-hmm.
And my response is, you've explained it away. Because it all comes back to Hamlet, doesn't it? There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of in your philosophy, Horatio. And your philosophy, Horatio, just accepts the reality of physical matter. So it's absolutely impossible for you to recognise that there could be anything like another side, some kind of knowledge of what's the other side of death. It's absolutely ruled out of court from the very beginning. Whereas, you know, in the world before science as we know it, that was all perfectly acceptable. It was all included in the cosmology that the dead in some sense survive, and that there's possibility of communication with them. These are all questions that there's a certain level where, in a way, you know, there's a little shelf of ontologies or cosmologies, and you can pull different ones off the shelf, you know, and each one has its own pluses and negatives, if you like. Once you pull the physicalistic science one off the shelf, the negative is that is your entire being is negated. It's quite a heavy price.
Does Adam, what's called something matter antimatter? Does that not come into anything to do with this?
Well, I don't know enough about about.
That's more of a recent discovery, isn't it?
Yes.
They didn't see. Before.
But anything that's understood within the paradigm of physicalistic science is not going to help. In terms of giving us an explanation of consciousness. You see, a different ontology, physicalistic science doesn't say, oh, we must give an explanation for the fact that there is physical stuff. I mean, the Big Bang is the explanation, it came out of nothing. That's okay, that's where it came from, it came out of nothing. We don't agonise over that. The agonising is over, but consciousness doesn't seem to fit into this. And there are many people who actually, as scientists, do recognise, and there is consciousness, that is a problem. But it doesn't fit in with our worldview. If you start with a worldview that says there is consciousness, you don't have to explain it anymore. It's something that you already accept that it is. It doesn't become a problem for you. In the same way that the being of matter isn't a problem for physicalistic science. You only end up having to explain stuff that doesn't fit in with the foundations that you already accept. Because in a way, it's an illusion to think that you could finally explain consciousness. You can't explain what is. I mean,
you could. It's obvious when you try to attempt an essay.
Yes.
And then you start thinking, what is consciousness?
But you see, what science presents itself with a problem that says, well, basically, this is what we accept as having absolute being, and our task is to explain everything else in terms of that. And that's where consciousness becomes a problem for science. Because it can't offer an explanation for it. So it says, well, it wants to sort of say, well, it's just the way it is. But it's, you see, if you understand what consciousness is, truly grasp what it is, which is just what it is to be conscious immediately now, you see that it just sits there as an anomaly for physicalistic science. And again, we're talking about this course. The idea of this course is to show that it doesn't have to be such an anomaly, that there are other ways of understanding our being here that doesn't negate science and doesn't negate consciousness. And to sort of point out, in a way, that this is terribly simple and terribly obvious. And how could we be paying a salary and granting this enormous respect to someone like Daniel Dennett when he's saying something that is so obviously ridiculous? How could we tolerate I don't like to use a strong word, stupidity? Because I think to some future society, let's say we get over this particular stage that we're in, that's how it's going to look. It's like when we look back on other civilizations, we see the things that they believed. I mean, we only have to look back into the slavery of the a few hundred years ago, where people were living under many people were living under a certain understanding of being, where slavery was okay. Right back into antiquity. And that hasn't gone either. But a large section of humanity now has got over that. That's odd, isn't it? You see, because that's having seen that slavery is something wrong with it. We're already more advanced than materialistic sciences in our recognition of the significance and reality of another person's experience. Because we're not against slavery just because it was bad economics, are we? We're not against slavery because it somehow goes against the laws of physics.
It's where veganism thinks it'll be in 100 years, isn't it?
Pardon?
Veganism thinks it will be in 100 years, that we'll look back at eating animals as having been a negation of their consciousness.
Or we come to an understanding of what it means to be conscious and what it is that distinguishes us from the animals. Because that's another vexed question that people get I went to a conference on consciousness, and that's a pretty hot topic now. And there are a lot there in this, because we've got this kind of attitude in a way that's growing, that there's a kind of a chauvinism in our privileging human consciousness. But where do you draw the line? With the fish? With the vegetables? There are the fruitarians. I only eat what falls on the ground. Or do we, in the end, artificially produce nourishment in the chemistry lab? But it goes on. I know a colleague who would say, well, what about the molecules? Because especially in panpsychism, that would, the assumption would be, well, the molecules, maybe they don't like being broken up by your digestive juices. What right have you got to destroy the integrity of the molecule? It just ain't right, is it? Do you see it? So you've got to, I think we're going to have...
Sorry, I'm going to have diversion.
No, and we could go that far, right? We could go that far and we could say, that you're right. We've got to become disembodied. We can't have bodies anymore with stomachs. Yeah, we should exist just as software. And that somewhere... All right, so you see, we're not going. That's my response to the vegan argument. But that's we'll have to see now. Finally, only now I got to Eagleman's thesis. It's a double reality thesis, if you listen to him carefully. And this is what philosophers do. I'm being a bit of a philosopher. Philosophers love to do this. They love to kind of decode what people are saying in terms of... it's quite revealing in terms of, well, what is it that what you're saying is predicated upon? What is it that you actually believe to be the case that you're not saying? And this isn't a bad way to approach... anyone who's ever trying to persuade you of anything. Public debate in this civilization is at an appalling level, isn't it? Where, in the Brexit, I'm not going to, I don't want to dwell on it, but, that isn't what the British people wanted. I mean, it just holds your head. The British people, that, there's no such entity to start with, right? There's just a bunch of people who turned out on a particular day and put crosses, you know. There's no British people, and there's nothing that they want. We deal with fictitious entities that we give reality to, and if we can just slip that across, you know, and it's often I see this, it's the speed of the hand deceives the eye. But if once you slip that across, once you slip the background across, you can then be as rational as you like. The only issue in all persuasion, in all rhetoric, is to set the background.
But I mean, like with the UK, you can go back to Jung and say, like, the collective consciousness, because that would, like, in the UK, they would have a collective consciousness different to, like, in Asia. So you can say that there could be a general persuasion with the view in the UK based on the collective consciousness of what they've been feeding in terms of, like, media.
Yes, indeed. Now, if one of the politicians was to stand up, and of course they're not going to, and say, well, I think this is what's happening in the collective consciousness of the country, that would be a step forward. But then it would still be like talking about the British people. How do you actually get a knowledge of what's happening in the collective consciousness of the British people, and the Jungian answer to that was you know, we would have to you know, take a kind of a survey. But if we were to accept Jung, the next stage we would say is, and it would be a very, very bad idea to act on the findings of what's going on in the collective consciousness of the British people. It would be a much better thing to try and raise the consciousness of the British people by getting everyone on the NHS to go into analysis. Yes.
Like the question of, like, a collective unconscious, even if, like, it was favoured on one side, it wouldn't have any, like, it wouldn't give any quality to what the collective consciousness actually is. Or it wouldn't be like there wouldn't be a measurement of the quality of the collective unconscious, even if it would just be like a general appeal to the masses.
Yes,
have any sustenance to it. It would just be an appeal to the masses without seeing what it is.
But I know we're digressing here, but if there were an understanding in the population at large that there is something like a collective consciousness, and it can go badly wrong, and I mean, the whole thing is, and the whole Jungian thing is predicated on the idea of the shadow, isn't it? Of the fact that you project what you can't accept in yourself onto other people. If you started to talk about the collective consciousness, that would be part of the understanding within which the whole society is working, and then we would be working within so why are you feeling so bad about the Poles, you know, the Polish people? Do you think there might be something going on in you there? You know, we aren't even near expressing an opinion like that to the British public, are we? Because, you know, and we digress. But you're right. The will of the people is whatever the person. I mean, it's just exploited. It's just. That's where we started. It's just exploited as if I can get it across to you, that just means you agree with me on this particular issue. It's nothing to do with the will of the people. The will of the people is fluctuating, isn't it? So, just to get this double thesis that Eagleman, because we're talking about trying to get behind the scenes of what someone's saying, and you if you try and get behind the scenes of what a politician is saying, generally you meet with something rather sinister, which is that the politician knew that they were setting the background. Yes? And they're doing it in a calculating attempt to gain support for a particular viewpoint. Eagleman isn't like that. I don't want to say he's like a politician. He genuinely accepts the background, I think, from which he's presenting. So he's, in a way, he's not exhibiting that kind of bad faith that a politician exhibits, and maybe has to exhibit. You know, I don't. Let's call in the politicians and say, well, what's it like trying to handle the British public? You know, I think the British public, you wouldn't want to tell them the truth. Sadly. So the real reality, and this is the reality that I want to go into really in this course, is what science discovers. I've been describing it as materialistic or physicalistic, but that's really a simplification, which the next two readings are going to go into. The science's view of reality is deeply mathematical, and this is where I'm worried about scaring people off, because it's almost like there's a kind of a division here about people who had some kind of good experience of mathematics at school and people who didn't. People tend to bifurcate over mathematics. And I don't think, in this course, I'm not going to be expecting you to do mathematics, but I don't think that you're going to be able to understand somehow the essence of science unless you understand mathematics. Because there's... it's not as if everybody decided to become materialists or physicalists. It's more that everyone decided that the best way to get to the truth is to first of all dispense with natural language, because natural language is imprecise and inadequate, and to develop a more precise language. And that more precise language is the language of mathematics. And the kind of science that we have is really, it's a mathematical science. And I don't think you really understand science until you understand the mathematical foundations of science, even if you're doing... as a scientist, you're not actually... I mean, I think you'll understand that for the physicists, they are mathematical physicists now. They're not physicists in any other way. They're working with mathematics more than matter. But that discovery of modern science was to do with mathematics, and that's what Husserl is going to be talking about in the reading. And understanding what mathematics is a kind of a task we have in front of us that I'd like you to engage with me and find interesting, even though it's... I think there's a certain... And it's in me. I'm an odd person in this respect. You know, I'm saying that almost humanity could be divided by those people who think... who are comfortable with mathematics and those that aren't. There's a kind of a middle ground, and I think I live on the middle ground. I was mathematics was my thing at school, but I didn't follow it up. I started a maths degree and then dropped it. And I have a certain distaste for the extreme abstraction that's required in order to do mathematics, which I think many people... experience something like that. It's because in order to do mathematics, you have to kind of empty the world of all its significance, all its human significance. And there are some people who really love that. Do you know, they love that world, the purity of it, the beauty and the symmetry and the harmony of it. People who are just aesthetically in love with mathematics. And there are others who think that it's just dead, inhumane. Do you know, I don't know if any of this rings anything, where you would be on that spectrum.
I hate.
Yes, there we go. There's one end of the spectrum. Because I'm reading Jung, I think it's almost like we have developed certain ways of dealing with the world, some people are extremely intellectual and mental, and those they tend to favour a mathematical approach to things, but it's got nothing to do with what we would traditionally call the heart. The heart, I think, is not mathematical.
I was listening to a program on YouTube with a Persian psychologist, and all the people that they have problem, they come and talk about their problems. Funny about that, he was telling that 90% of the people that they studied mathematics and their jobs are engineer and all those things, they are really very bad on sentimental things, and the relationship, they don't know what to do. They just don't understand it.
Yes.
So it's just something, I think, if you're good in mathematics, you just cut off that other part, yeah? Because you don't like it.
Yes, well, I mean, in a way, if you study, and this is what I discovered at Warwick, if you study mathematics, you can't, it's not a subject that you can do by half measures.
Mm-hmm.
You have to really give your life energy to it, and you can't, if you give your life energy to something like that, you have to take it from somewhere else. You know, one's only got a certain amount, so you end up kind of impoverished in other areas.
Yeah.
Do you know? But the mathematician goes around recognizing how impoverished everyone else is in his area or her area. Do you know what I mean? How everyone's thinking is so woolly, so imprecise, and also people don't see the deeper structure in things, because the deeper structure of things is mathematical. I gave you as a reading, I don't know if you took up on it, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, just a little bit on science. But if you enjoy that at all, the one of the main themes of that book was division between the classic and the romantic, and that pertains to what we're saying here. In a way, Robert Pirsig is a bit of a mathematician or a philosopher, and he's a defender, if you like, of that classic view. That scientific view. He appreciates the beauty of it, and the book is partly about trying to reconcile these two approaches in a way, the approach that's more of the heart. I mean, the heart's a poetic way of saying it, but it seems that there are. In my own life, I think I started off strongly intellectual, but I've had to pay attention to other aspects of my being, you know, just because otherwise you can't really sustain a loving relationship, putting it bluntly. not really. Anyway, I think we'll have another break now before I can entirely give up on getting through this lecture. I've still got ambitions to look at a few of the details at the end. So I'll turn the recording off now. So this is lunch proper.